I'm Eric Dempsey, known as the Birdman, and I've been contributing to Mooney Goes Wild for many years.
Mooney Goes Wild, celebrating 25 years on RTE Radio 1.
And welcome to the programme. Today we bring you a feast of trad in the guise of Paddy Glacken and Donal Lunny as they introduce us to some tunes inspired by birds. Terry Flanagan cancels a sleep-deprived Mooney listener who can't get shut-eye because of the noisy gulls on her rooftop. And it's got to be the kindest and cruelest picture in nature. A robin feeding its offspring. Only it's not. It's a cuckoo.
We were just sitting at the kitchen table, breakfast, looking out, and the bird feeders are just outside the window. You just automatically always going to be glancing out at them anyway. Next thing, John had just said to me, look at the end of the garden there, there's a big bird. What is it like? And I got the camera out and I still had my pyjamas on. Next thing I'm out trying to zoom in to see, can I get a photograph of it? So I just posted it on bird identification. And within seconds, I had answers back right away that it was a cuckoo. But we didn't realise till later that the robin was actually feeding it.
So a very busy programme ahead of us today. We don't want you to text us today. It's not that we don't like you. We do like you. But this is a specially recorded programme about birds and music. So in Studio 6 with me today, we have Niall Hatch. Niall.
Hi, Derek.
We have Eric Dempsey. A welcome return to you, Eric.
Hello, Derek.
And in Malahide, we have Dr. Richard Collins at home cocooning.
All's well out here, Derek.
Very good, Richard. And across the corridor in Studio 8, we have the best of traditional musicians this country has bred. Paddy Glacken and Donal Lunny, and they're going to entertain us this evening with some music inspired by birds. Paddy.
Thank you very much, Derek, and it's great to be here on Mooney Goes Wild. I'm Paddy Glacken and I play the fiddle.
And I'm Donal Lunny and I'll be playing bouzouki, although this particular bouzouki on this particular tune is a baritone bouzouki called a zouk.
Very exotic indeed.
Indeed.
And we're going to be playing some tunes which are associated with bird life. And in the Irish folk music tradition, there are loads and loads of references to birds of all sorts. And we're going to start off with a tune which is really, really popular, a tune that I think nearly every traditional musician knows. It's a tune called The Lark in the Morning. And I think, Donal, this would be a tune that you would have recorded at some stage.
It's quite true. My stint with an outfit called Moving Hearts, we used to play a long set of tunes, which we called, collectively, we called it The Lark, because it started off with The Lark in the Morning. And I'm sure that in my earliest days, playing guitar with the musicians down in Pat Dowling's pub down in Prosperous, I'm sure The Lark in the Morning was one of the first tunes I heard. It's such a great tune and such a favourite.
Yeah, and I suppose my association of it would be going to sessions in the Hollybrook Hotel in Clontarf way back in the 60s, and it would have been one of the first tunes I'd have learnt at one of these sessions when all the musicians would be playing together. And it was a big tune with four parts, so I thought that was a great achievement to be able to learn it. So why don't we give it a go?
Give it a lash.
Thank you.
Michael Moncalia's Donal Lundy and Paddy Glacken over in Studio 8 playing us tunes inspired by birds.
Absolutely beautiful, isn't it? It's really, really gorgeous song. And what I was getting there with the tune, the way that it continually flows like that without a pause, it is the way a skylark sings. Yeah. It's really evocative like that. And one of the most celebrated of all of our songbirds. And it's captured lovely, perfectly in music there. Beautiful.
I found myself sort of closed my eyes listening to the music there. And you can actually visualise yourself being out in a bog and the lark singing. That piece of music just captures the essence of a skylark. It's extraordinary that a human being can create music that actually captures a wildness. It's a beautiful piece.
Didn't you feature the Skylarks on the Dawn Chorus with us 1 year?
That's right. We were out on the Bull Island. We were doing the Dawn Chorus. And, of course, the Skylarks will sing very early. And even out through the night, you'll often get them. I've been doing some bird surveys this summer. And, you know, you'll hear them almost at midnight. They're still out there singing, you know. And of course, the skylark doesn't perch. It sings very, very high up because they nest on the ground and they live in wild, open mm-hmm. areas. So the skylark is the bird that will sing, you know, as a little tiny dot up in the sky, and then it will descend. But it's amazing how loud and how far carrying that song is, even if it's Absolutely. Several hundred metres up. It's incredible.
Because we're not talking about a very big bird here. You know, it's not much bigger than a robin, really. It's bigger wings and so forth because it's very good at flying, but it's not a very large bird. And it goes high up in the sky like this, singing all the time with this continuous song that without a pause. And what the male there is doing, because as with most of our Irish birds, it's just the male that does the singing, he's trying to proclaim a territory and to impress a female. And it seems from studies that have been done, the female is impressed by the male who can take the biggest risks, because the higher he goes and the more he sings, the more he's broadcasting his position to every predator in the neighbourhood. So it's kind of a big gamble he's taking. He's showing that he's daring and that he's confident, and this is a very attractive quality to a female skylark, it seems. One of the questions I'm often asked about skylarks is, how do they manage to keep singing this continuous song for minutes on end without pausing for breath? And what's actually amazing about that is that the bird is breathing. It's breathing all the time. They breathe a lot more frequently than we do. What happens is birds can sing whether the air is going in or coming out. It makes no difference. It's a performance, because that's what it is. Birdsong is a very aggressive thing. It's a very, it's a really in-your-face macho thing as well, because he wants to impress this female.
Richard.
Derek, yes. a few wayward thoughts. The behaviour of this bird when it comes to song is most peculiar in two respects particularly. Song is normally a kind of dialogue. It's a proclamation. The wren will sing, the blackbird will sing, and the robin will sing, but they will listen. They say, is there anybody there? They put out this notice, I'm occupying this territory, or if you're a female that fancy a very healthy male, I am here waiting for you. But the skylark doesn't do that. He keeps singing non-stop. He doesn't listen out for anybody. That's a very strange thing. The other very strange thing is the energetics. Suppose you scaled a skylark up to the size of us, and you were standing by a skylark as big as us, and then he started to sing, he would damage your ears. It would be like standing beside a jet engine. Now, the energy required to do that is absolutely enormous. Now, he takes off. He starts to sing at this ferocious, shouting at the top of his voice kind of thing, and yet he flies and flutters all the way up to about 50 metres. Now, he's doing two very energetic things at the same time. The question is, why does he go to this trouble? This is extraordinary. Surely he should balance them. It suggests that the females are going to be impressed by somebody with all the energy to fly that high and keep singing that long. But I think the greatest thing of all is this, what the skylark does at the end. He's a skydiver. He falls. They just pull the wings together and fall like a stone the whole way down. And you think they're going to hit the ground. And at the last second, they open the wings and flutter down. It's not a peregrine stoop, but it's one of the great sights of Irish nature, I think.
Fully agree with you, Richard. It's a wonderful thing to watch. And, you know, meadow pipits do a sort of a parachute glide. They do a similar song from the air, but nothing as spectacular as that sort of fall from the air of skylarks. They just drop, as you say, like stones. And the other interesting thing, of course, is that in all my years, I've only ever found one or two skylark nests. Mm-hmm. And it's usually when a bird, you almost walk on it, because what happens is the skylark will land and doesn't land near the nest. They will land 50, 100 metres from the nest and then walk through the grass unseen to the nest. So
I was going to ask you, have you ever seen a skylark walk?
Well, they scurry, yeah, they do, yeah.
But have you seen it?
Yeah, oh, yeah, I have.
Oh, you have seen
it? Yeah, yeah,
I imagine they look like a mouse or something like that on the grass.
No, they can be. They can be a bit sort of mouse-like, almost like a snow bunting. Yeah, but they scurry to their nests. You can never really find a skylark's actual nest unless you almost stand on it.
Anyway, are you ready for more music?
Oh, absolutely. We are.
Shall we go back to the boys?
Yes.
In Studio 8, Donal Lunny and Paddy Glacken.
Right, Derek, the next tune we're going to play is another tune that is pretty well known in the country, a tune that's played by nearly every musician. It's a tune called The Swallow's Tale.
Oh, yes.
Did you ever encounter many swallows, particularly around where you grew up?
Yeah, well, I'm thinking back to growing up in Newbridge. I suppose I was preteen. I used to go out to Cox's farm with my schoolmate, Tom Cox, in their cowshed out there every spring. Swallows would arrive and nest in the cowshed, and we used to watch them zooming in through the yard and in through the door of the barn at about 50 miles an hour and, into their nests and back out again. They were brilliant. Beautiful birds.
Mm. Yeah, my wife, Maya, she's a keen observer of birds, and she always gets very, very excited when she comes across a swallow.
Mm.
And this particular tune, again, as I said, it's a sort of a tune that I think everybody has learned when they were starting out.
Mm.
And yet it's one of these tunes that has endured.
Yes.
And it's still played. And because I think basically it's just a really, really good tune.
Yeah, that's
so
great.
Will we give it a go?
We will. But I was just thinking there, another memory that I have from, I suppose, back around the same time was down on the banks of the Liffey, which flowed through Newbridge, at one watering place. I remember seeing a bunch of swallows on a mud flat. They obviously landed to drink water. And it's very strange to see a swallow on the ground.
Right.
But they managed to kind of, had a kind of awkward kind of taken off, you know. But which, unlike swifts, who never land on the ground apparently, they sleep on the wing. They've sort of fall out of the nest as fledglings and start to fly, so they never touch the ground.
Will we give the swallow's tail a twist?
Give the swallow's a twist anyway, yeah, yeah.
it's lovely. You could nearly see the swallow kind of flying in and out there and up and down and around and swinging more, because the tail is what it's all about when it comes to the swallow. And it's called the swallow's tail, that tune.
That long,
it gives it the agility.
Yes, it gives that manoeuvrability. And, you know, just listening to that music, I could see swallows like catching insects over the fields. And and I was listening to Donald there. He was right. Swifts are the ones that don't land on the ground, but swallows will frequently land on the ground. So when Donald observed them on the mud flats along the Liffey, the chances are they were possibly picking up mud pellets to build their nests, because they can use up to 1,000 mud pellets to build their nests. And they go into these muddy areas, gather up little balls of mud, and then place them almost like brickwork and build that nest.
That's right. It's amazing that they make these mud bricks out of mixing the mud with the saliva. It sounds very strange to us. But of course, if you don't have hands and you have to transport this mud over long distance, carrying in your beak makes a lot of sense. People often ask, you know, how do I tell the difference between a swallow and a house martin? And one of the best ways to do it is by their nests. People sometimes think the swallows are nesting under the eaves of their house. That's always actually the house martins that do that. Swallows build their nests inside a structure, so inside a shed or a barn or a garage, someplace like that, a porch maybe. Goodness knows what they did before we humans came on the scene, because they're very dependent now on human buildings and structures. The house martin, they'll always build on the outside of the structure, under an overhangs, under the eaves, under the gutters, that kind of area. It's often the apex of the roof. Well, that's often where you'd see them.
The tail, though, it's all about the tail.
Oh,
that tune is about the tail.
All birds, you know, forked tails tend to be very manoeuvrable. You know, terns, swallows, you know.
Kites, red kites.
Kites, red kites. There's even birds that live in the tropics called frigate birds, and they're big seabirds, and they've got long forked tails. So that long tail gives you a manoeuvrability in the air. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you think about what a swallow does, he's catching insects on the wing. Think about trying to catch a fly with your hand. It's very, very difficult.
So you're saying if I had a forked tail,
it would be easier. If you had a forked tail, you'd probably be able to do it, Derek. The whole success of rearing young depends on being able to find so many insects to feed your chicks. And they may have two or three broods. So without that long tail, if they lost those long tail streamers, they may not have the manoeuvrability.
Richard.
Yeah, that's interesting. The tail, the word, I believe, comes from old German, meaning a forked stick. Some research some years ago showed that the swallow males that do best are the ones with symmetrical tails. Apparently, if you're handsome, both sides of your face are symmetrical. They match each other. They're mirror images of each other. And the swallows that have mirror image tails, it was alleged, do better, produce more young, and get better females, and so on. Than the other. Now, why then would the swallow go singing all the time? And they sing and twitter an awful lot of the time. But there's an even greater mystery. If singing is all about getting territory and getting mates, why do young swallows sing so much? And from the beginning of August on, the young swallows will be singing away. There'll be no shutting them up on the wires and everywhere else. What on earth are they at?
Because they're not looking for a mate at that stage.
No, and no,
because they're just preparing to make their journey back to Africa.
Are they possibly learning the song? Because what often happens with many birds, like chaffinches, there's a lot of studies done on chaffinches. Chaffinches born late in the summer don't have the chaffinch song. They learn it the following year. But chaffinches born earlier in the year have acquired the basics of a chaffinch song because they've heard their parents singing. So I wonder, are those young swallows learning the song and practicing the song, and will have it perfected when they return
next year? When they return next year, you see.
And if you think of that return journey that they have to make, they travel such a distance. I find it remarkable that a pair of swallows can leave Ireland, head down to southern Africa. They're flying around with the giraffes and the lions and the elephants. They come back to exactly the same barn or shed to nest again. So that long forked tail that they have, it's a very important tool to enable them to fly those long distances. And with that tail, as we've said, it gives them great manoeuvrability. It means they can turn very quickly in the air. The symmetry of the tail, as Richard said, is what the female finds particularly attractive. So swallows and tails are essential for each other, inextricably linked. The tail is the most important part of that bird.
Niall, I will never look at a swallow's tail the same way again. Thank you very much indeed for the moment, boys. I want to make a detour, if you don't mind, because this is the breeding season for seabirds on colonies all around our coast, and indeed on the man-made colonies we call our homes. Anybody who's ever had the pleasure or displeasure of having visitors living on the roof, and I'm talking about gulls, will know what this next story is all about. It's music of a sort, but not music to people's ears first thing in the morning. More like a racket noisy neighbours, and they choose to live with us for a reason, because it's close to food. Our food. One of the funniest videos I've seen recently is of a guy walking down a Dublin street and he has a burger in his hand. And just as he's about to take a bite of his beef burger, a herring gull, which was stalking him, swoops in and nicks it. And there was hilarity all round, not from the guy who had his burger nicked, but all the people who were watching, particularly the guy who had his phone in his hand and was recording it on the camera. Anyway, Terry Flanagan has more on this story of, let's call them, nuisance neighbours. Terry.
Yeah, but it's not just on the city streets they've become a nuisance. Case in point is Maura McCarthy, who lives in Glasnevin.
Now, come down here to the end of the garden, Terry. You'll see them for yourself.
Well, I can hear them already. Hear them, yeah. Yeah, OK, I'm looking up there at the roof and I can see them. Tell us your story, Maura.
Well, every morning, it can vary between 5 o'clock and 7 o'clock.
Yeah.
There are three babies in a nest very close to my house.
Yeah, they're not actually on your roof.
No, they're not on my roof. They're two houses over and I can see the nest from mine. But they have three little chicks and they come every morning because I have a skylight on my roof.
Yeah.
And they come over and they tap on that endlessly every morning. But as they've got bigger, they've got louder and they just wake, they'd wake anybody up. So they're... It's a terrifying sound in the morning because you just can't get your morning, your day's sleep anymore, your night's sleep.
And do you notice it? Is it getting any worse?
I think it's got worse now since they have got bigger. Mm. The little chicks, they're a few weeks, good few weeks old now. And since they've got bigger, their pecking sound is a lot louder. And then the mammy and the daddy, like protecting them, their sound has got to be really loud altogether, very loud.
So. I can imagine when you're up there in the attic and if you open that skylight, they must go crazy.
Absolutely crazy, and I think, as far as I'm concerned, they'd wake the dead. Anyway, yeah. They're so loud, and they seem to gather around. It's just not the two, the mammy and the daddy and the chicks.
Yeah, we can see them flying around here.
There's a whole colony of them seem to come around, and then I have seen them having nearly bird parties because some pigeons join them at times, and I've seen the magpies with them. So there's an awful lot of them together, like, so they make an awful lot of noise, and not it's not just me complaining about them, but my neighbours as well. So they hear that sound every morning. It seems to wake them up as well, because from talking to them, mostly they say around 5 o'clock in the morning.
So that's Maura, and as you can hear, she's not too happy to have the gulls on her roof, especially first thing in the morning. Why are they there, Terry?
Well, it's the time of the year, Derek. It's the breeding season for the birds. And traditionally, these gulls are herring gulls. They would have nested on islands and on cliff tops.
Is it only herring gulls?
On the roof, it's only herring gulls. Yes, it's only herring gulls. And traditionally, they would have nested, as I said, on the islands and that. But their numbers have dropped considerably in the last 30 years or so. I think it's down something like 90%. In one sense, they've been driven off the islands and they're moving into the cities. And why wouldn't they fly up and down Grafton Street or O'Connell Street or Henry Street when there's loads and loads of food there for them? So, of course, they're coming in
for
the food.
They're exploiting us, Terry.
They are indeed. But not only just for the food, they've also learned to start nesting here inland. So they're nesting in towns, coastal towns, along the coast of, say, County Dublin. County Waterford is another one. And that's why Maura has gotten in touch with us, because they're nesting on her roof and she has the problem with it.
So what can I do? Or is there anything I can do about them, Terry?
Well, the first thing I should say is that not all gulls nest on roofs. Now, these gulls here are herring gulls and they do. I would say, first of all, that they are a protected species. You can't touch them, you can't do anything with them. And the nests, they're also protected. So you can do nothing about the nests at the moment, except maybe just wear some earplugs at night, but that's not good enough. You want something better than that. Shiny tapes, hanging CDs, you've probably heard of that before. They do that for other birds. Will it work? Possibly it'll work. It's short term, it's not really going to work. There is some research that says that red colour, they don't seem to like red colour, so maybe putting something red up on the roof. Really what you need to do is you need to leave it this year until they're finished nesting. And when they're finished nesting, then you have to do something about it. Now, I know that this nest isn't on your roof, it's on your neighbour's roof. Is that right?
That's right, yes. Probably.
So he's two doors down, is that
right? That's
right. So you have to speak to him about it. But there are a number of things you can do. You can put up hawk kites. That's a kite on a piece of string and it kind of flies up there. And they don't like hawks. So that will tend to frighten them away somewhat. Or terrorise, that's another one. terror, T-E-R-R-O-R, eyes, E-Y-E-S. So get something like a big ball or a big balloon and paint two big red eyes in it and put it on the roof. And hopefully that might have some effect. But to be honest, you'd want to be a little bit more serious about it. And there are a number of companies on the net. And if you get onto them, get onto their websites and you can see what can be done. Bird wire, for instance. So if a bird can't land on the roof, then he won't be able to nest on the roof. Right. So if you take some or get a company to put some wire, some metal wire, stretch it across the roof, kind of a zigzag fashion across the roof, then they won't be able to land. So if they can't land, then they can't build a nest. Or bird spikes, you probably see those in some of the buildings. Now, yeah, people seem to think that the bird spike is there to kill the bird. No, yeah, it's not. These are absolutely humane spikes. They are blunt at the end and they won't stab the bird, but it'll prevent them from landing on the roof. And if it prevents them from landing on the roof, then they won't be able to nest. Or bird netting. You can put up netting and it'll be kind of a wire netting. And this wire netting will stop them again from landing on the roof. Or I see a more recent one is a laser deterrent, where you can put up these laser lights on the roof and they flash. I think it's green colour. And again, it stops them. But what I would say is that there are a number of different precautions that you can take that will stop them from nesting next year. But you can't do anything at the moment because they're nesting. That's the sad part. Except, as I said, maybe the earplugs, but that's only going to help you at night. Mm. I don't know, what do you think of that?
As you say, but they're not on my roof as such. Mm. The nest isn't on my roof, so I guess I'll have to talk to my neighbour and see if we can do anything to prevent them from coming back next year, because I'm not prepared to spend another year listening to their noises.
But wait until the nesting season is over. So that'll probably be about another 6 weeks or so.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks very much, Terry, for your help.
Thank you, Terry. And Maura will return with more music after this break.
Mooney Goes Wild, celebrating 25 years on RTE Radio 1. Email mooney@rte.ie.
Don't forget, you can visit our website anytime you like. It's rte.ie/Mooney. In studio with me here in Studio 6, we have Eric Dempsey and Niall Hatch at home, cocooning in Malahide. We've got Dr. Richard Collins. And across the corridor in Studio 8, we've got Donal Lunny and Paddy Glacken bringing us some music today inspired by birds. Paddy, it's all yours.
So, Derek, the next tune we're going to play is a tune which I suppose is called after the most recognisable bird in the country, the blackbird. In Irish, it's called an lundu, the male version of it. And of course, you always have an kershuk, which is the female version of it. And in traditional music, it is hugely celebrated because there's a certain tune called the blackbird. It's played in nearly all parts of the country, and indeed, some parts have their own particular versions of it. And it's also a tune that was danced to, that which there were particular steps composed, and the set dance would be danced by old dancing masters back in the last century. So it's a really popular tune and a very, very interesting tune. I'm not surprised, because the blackbird gives, I think it gives so much pleasure when you get up in the morning and you see it there, you know, foraging for food, and it's a lovely sight to see in your back garden.
I love blackbirds. I have loads of recordings of them. Any chance I get to record them, because they've got an infinity of variations that they sing, and they have some dominant notes, and they're the ones that you hear, but it's usually followed by a flurry of squeaks and bleeps, and some of them are so detailed and so fine they don't impinge on your, you know, on your hearing. But a friend of mine who lives in Italy, she's Italian, Antonella De Palma, herself and her partner, Cesare Bermani, they have a pet blackbird that, well, it's a wild blackbird, which they call Merlino. And it frequents the back garden. And I've seen it on occasion, and it's not afraid. It hops along through the bushes, but it, from time to time, goes into their kitchen, will hop into the kitchen and hang about. Like, well, I suppose robins do that as well. Mm. I think they're very bright, they're very clever birds.
And there was also, there was a great collection of music called An Lundu Agus an Kershuk, which was published, I think, in Galway back in the 40s or 50s. Mm. Wonderful collection of tunes. But the blackbird, as I said, like, it's just, it's so celebrated in the music. And I think the version we're going to play now, this is a version I learned from a man who would have observed blackbirds and many other birds, a man by the name of John Doherty, who was a travelling fiddle player, came from a wonderful family of professional musicians who could trace their lineage back to the O'Donnells in Donegal. And John was certainly one of my great inspirations as a musician. Hmm. We're going to play his version of it. I'll play the air version of it first. I'll just play that once through. And then we'll go into his particular set dance version of it.
So. Good.
There you go, Derek. That was the Blackbird.
Thank you very much indeed, Paddy. I'm just wondering, though, Niall, listening to that, what makes that tune sound like a blackbird?
It actually is very evocative of a blackbird to me.
Because
it is because it's in the lower register of the fiddle. It's kind of the lower pitched. It's not the high notes. It's kind of very mellow and sort of meandering. It's not a fast-paced, frenetic tune. That's just like a blackbird. And also, the way the melody kept changing, it's not a set tune all the way through. That's like the blackbird. I always think of the blackbird as being a great improviser. It doesn't sing a set tune like, let's say, a Yellowhammer or a Chaffinch or a Chiff Chaff would. It changes all the time.
And it's watching, the big eye.
Absolutely.
Well, the big wake first thing in the morning.
Well, always on the Dawn Chorus programme, one of the big highlights for me each year is listening out for that first blackbird, because the blackbird is always one of the birds that starts singing first in the morning because of the big eye. And the reason for that is the bigger the eye, the more light it gathers, because the bigger the retina, and therefore the bird can see in low light, because birds generally aren't happy to sing unless they can see predators coming, because as we said with the skylark earlier, when they're singing, every predator in the neighbourhood knows exactly where they are, so they won't sing until it's safe to do so. So the bigger the eye, the earlier you can get away with it.
But a blackbird as a pet, albeit a wild one?
Well, it's obviously learned it's onto a good thing there in Italy, and will find food. Birds are opportunists. And one of the reasons why blackbirds are quite successful as a species is that they're generalists in a way. You know, they like to eat worms. They also like to eat berries and fruit. They can switch. So, you know, I think that the blackbird obviously knows that it's being well looked after.
And especially in Italy, it's to be well fed.
Absolutely, no
and
better
watered,
place.
So to speak. Merlino, isn't that the name it was given? Anyway, let's move on back to Studio 8. We are in Studio 6 and just across the corner. corridor is where Studio 8 is. We're subterranean. All of the studios in the RT Radio Centre are below the surface. But at any rate, over in Studio 8, they're even subterranean, because here we come in on one level, you go into Studio 8 and you go down another level. You go down steps and you're in this wonderful studio for performing artists, which is where Paddy Glacken and Donal Lunny are with their penultimate tune.
Right, Derek, our next piece of music celebrates the cuckoo. And the cuckoo is a bird that holds a very, very special place in our house at home, and particularly when we go to Donegal, because out at the back of the house in a place called Upper Door, we wait with bated breath waiting to hear the cuckoo. My wife's aunt, Kitty, who's still hale and hearty and was a wonderful singer, she always would say to us that she would be waiting hard to hear the cuckoo, that it was the first sort of sound of summer and of good times ahead. It's the most beautiful sound.
Pure magic.
Will we try it?
Have a go.
Richard Collins, you're a fan of the cuckoo, are you not?
I am indeed, Derek. He's a very Irish bird in some ways. He's the great rogue. He's the fox of the bird world. Flurry Knox, Juxer Daly, the chancers, the deceivers, all is up to tricks and things. He is an amazing bird. He's a fascinating bird. From nothing is quite as interesting as the seven deadly sins. The seven deadly virtues are very boring things. Nobody stays at home reading the lives of the saints. They like to read about those who go off and do bad things, and the cuckoo is the one.
Speak for yourself, but you better explain to our listeners what you mean.
Yeah, well, the cuckoo lays its eggs in the nests of other birds. Brood parasitism is the big fancy term for that, and it gets these host parents to raise its young for it. It's a great trick. It says, well, actually, if you work it out, it doesn't save him much in the way of energy, because he has to do an awful lot of work to do it, but we haven't time to go into all of that. But do you remember our most memorable day with the Nick Davies in Wicken Fen? Marvellous. And some of the things that Nick said have always stayed with me. Now, one is, I think in a sense, the song, the beautiful cuckoo, the minor third, E flat to C, that wonderful song captivates you and you tend not to hear any of the other songs. But perhaps the most interesting sounds cuckoos make are those the baby makes in the nest. Remember, cuckoo's in the nest, reed warbler nest over there. The four eggs have been thrown out, and this huge bird has to last much longer in that nest because it's got to keep the parents feeding it for much longer. Now, that means it's got to trigger. He has learned the feeding call of the duped parents, shall we say. And the other thing is, he's got to do all the shouting. If there were four reed warblers in the nest, each one would do some of the shouting, so they would distribute the energy load there. But the baby cuckoo must do all the triggering of the parents, and he has to do that for much longer. And of course, there are all kinds of problems. There's an interesting, Raymond O'Connor is a famous Irish ornithologist of the 20th century. He was director of the VTO. Well, now he came across a very interesting observation about young cuckoos. He found that in Ireland, he found a young cuckoo mimicking the feeding call of a meadow pipit. Now, in England, where it's all reed warblers, the young cuckoo must mimic the call of the reed warbler, do you see? It's no use shouting reed warbler calls to meadow pipits. They don't respond. But Raymond O'Connor heard the meadow pipit call coming from a cuckoo in the nest. Now, the cuckoo learns to camouflage its eggs, and here it's learning, it would seem, it may also, the young cuckoo, be mimicking
the Bonatra Nokuic, the meadow pipit, isn't it? The cuckoo's nurse.
The cuckoo's nursemaid,
indeed,
yes.
Indeed. And that's the species that it usually parasitises here in Ireland, as we know. But let me tell you, last week we put a call out where we asked you, our listeners, to send your wildlife recordings, photographs and videos into the show. And you've been doing it. We got a huge reply on almost every conceivable wild species from all over the country. And your work can now be seen on our Facebook and Twitter feeds. But the biggest reaction, and I mean the biggest, with the most engagement, shares, etc., was that of a robin. That's a little robin. Now, you know what a robin looks like? Feeding a cuckoo chick. Now, we know that the cuckoo is a brood parasite, as Richard has said. It lays eggs in the nests of other birds. But the cuckoo chick is near adult size, which is about 120 grams, where the adult robin is about 20 grams, or about 6 times smaller. You got to see this picture. rte.ie/Mooney. It was sent in to us by Maureen Carr in Kilcar, County Donegal. Our own John Bell O'Reilly asked Maureen, when did she first notice this strange feeding time spectacle in her garden?
We were just sitting at the kitchen table, breakfast, looking out, and the bird feeders are just outside the window. You just automatically always going to be glancing out at them anyway. Next thing, John had just said to me, look at the end of the garden there, there's a big bird. What is it like? And while we were looking out at it then, you know, we knew we hadn't seen it before. And John kind of checked the book and he thought maybe it's a sparrowhawk or something. And we kept looking to see, wondering what it was. And I got the camera out and I still had my pyjamas on. Next thing I'm out trying to zoom in to see, can I get a photograph of it? And eventually I got a photograph and happened to be a wee bird beside it. So I just posted it on bird identification. And within seconds, I had answered back right away that it was a cuckoo. And then for the rest of that afternoon, the day just seemed to disappear because it kept coming closer and moving to different parts of the garden. The wee birds weren't afraid of it or anything. But we didn't realise till later that the robin was actually feeding it. And I just kept snapping away and looking at it with the binoculars and every time it appeared. And you could hear the cry of the cuckoo, the sound of it. And every time I heard that, I knew it was going to get fed by the robin again.
So we know, Maureen, that cuckoos lay their eggs in the nests of other birds who are fooled then into raising the infant cuckoo as one of their own. So was the cuckoo in the robin's nest?
I would think so. Definitely the robin was feeding this like it was one of her own.
Was there a nest there, Maureen?
No, there's no nest in our garden that we could see anyway. I wouldn't think that there's any birds nesting in the garden itself. But I'm in a rural area and there's a lot of gardens and fields around my house, so there could be nesting anywhere, you know.
Where was the robin feeding the cuckoo?
In different areas in the garden. It started off, noticed it on a tree, and then one stage it was feeding it on the garden bench, and then it was feeding it on a stone area. It was moving, it was never in the same place. And then the last place it was feeding was actually over on, I have a water table for the birds, and the cuckoo was there, and that's the robin came to feed it there as well.
So there was a clear connection between the two birds?
Oh, there was definitely a clear connection. Now, we would have two robins in the garden. So I think both robins were feeding the cuckoo.
Oh, isn't that just wonderful? What a great story. Thank you very much indeed, Maureen. And the photograph really has to be seen to be believed. When I saw it, I went, what? My, woo, where? When? Anyway, no.
Actually, yeah, the photograph, the size difference between the chick and the parent, unwitting foster parent, is really remarkable. And it is quite unusual in Ireland for robins to be raising cuckoo chicks. I have seen it in Poland, all right, but not here in Ireland. And I think what may have happened in this case was that perhaps the intended host species, perhaps a meadow pipit or a dunnock, wasn't available. Maybe the female cuckoo had to lay her eggs in any nest she could find. And because the robins aren't the usual parasite or aren't the usual host for this parasite within Ireland, what happens is that they probably don't have a defence mechanism to spot this rogue egg in the nest, so they just would raise it. Very often birds that are used to being parasitised by cuckoos, they would recognise the eggs and throw them out. But in this case, no.
Well, if you can't get enough of cuckoos or cuckoo or cuckoo or however you want to say it yourself, tomorrow night, your second chance to hear on Mooney Goes Wild from our documentary archive is all about the cuckoo. And in this clip, I'm talking to Susan O'Donoghue from Croke North in County Clare about the cuckoos she observes during the Countryside Bird Survey, which takes place every year.
Cuckoo features very heavily in this area. It's not doing so great in other parts of Ireland, but here in the Burren and also along across the bay there in Connemara, that holds the highest number of breeding pairs. So it's doing really well. At the most now I've seen here in the years, 7 individuals, or not only seen, maybe just heard over the hour and a half, 2 hours I come here. Now last year was really, really phenomenal for me. Now I had been coming 5 years, and then I got to see 2 birds. So on one side of the square, I had 2 males flying beside each other, and they were calling each other. And down the other side of the square, I used my binoculars, open country so you can see far away. There were 2 cuckoos on a wall, and one of them was flying down to the nests. And you could hear a bubbling, so one of them was a female. And she was flying down to the ground, landing on the ground, and all the meadow pipits were rising and reacting, trying to get her out.
It's a lovely documentary. You can hear it tomorrow night right here on RTE Radio 1 from 10 p.m. And again, we'll be live with you next Sunday. We have a special about seabird colonies because this is the time of year when the seabirds are breeding. I want to say thank you very much indeed to my contributors today, to Niall Hatch. Niall, thank you. To Eric Dempsey, great to see you again, Eric, and we'll talk to you next week. And to Richard Collins all the way out there in Malahide. Our broadcast coordinator is Jarlath Holland. On sound, we had Kieran Cullen, and the researcher is John Bella Riley. And we've got to thank Paddy Glacken and Donal Lunny. Perhaps the boys can give us one last tune to say goodbye.
Okay, well, I suggested that we just throw in this tune that we play together on our gigs.
Mm-hmm.
When Paddy and I are playing together on gigs, we often finish with a set of tunes which has this one at the end of it.
Yeah, well, it's a version of a tune called Hand Me Down the Tackle, which again is a pretty common tune.
Mm.
But this version comes from John Doherty, the man we spoke of earlier on.
Well, no big surprises there.
No big surprises there.
Given how many versions of tunes you play that you learned from him.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, he was the main man for me for so many years. He was an absolutely wonderful musician.
Mm.
Everybody needs a bit of inspiration in their life, and certainly John was the man for me. So this is his version of Hand Me Down the Tackle. So
deadly.
Thanks a lot for having us, Derek. It's been great to share the music associated with birds and bird life, and hopefully we'll do it again sometime. So here we go.
Deadly.
Mooney Goes Wild was presented and produced by Derek Mooney.